Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think it's a really interesting analysis. I think, you know, in a way, probably sacrifice is maybe more the essence of heroism than the essence of love, because I think in a way the truly admirable hero will be a person who, of course, who is willing to sacrifice himself, which is why I mean, that's the whole, in a way, also the great appeal and essence also of Christianity, that we have like the ultimate sacrifice being made, and therefore the greatest hero in Jesus. I think that you know, if a hero does not sacrifice something, in what way can he still be a hero? Because or at least doesn't risk everything, you know, or you know, be willing. I mean, risk in a way is the will to sacrifice something. I mean, if he doesn't do that, you know, how can he be a hero? I mean, I think that in a way the love side of the sacrifice. I mean, I do see that sometimes. I mean, think of Titanic, for example, you know, was all about that, and I think that in a way that was probably also what the essence of it was. I think that if you have, and actually in Titanic it was really funny, because I think it was in a way one of the things that what I always really wondered about is, I think that raft that she was on should have been a little narrower, because, you know, it really felt like she could have pulled him up on there and they could have both made it, you know. But at the same time,
the same thing.
Yeah. I was thinking they could actually alternate, you know, you take 5 minutes
or that, exactly, know. Yeah, or something. I mean, something like that. I mean, it was just there. I think they should have, in a way, made the necessity of the sacrifice important as well, because I mean, I don't believe in unnecessary sacrifice, and that's in a way also a problem a little bit that I have with Christianity about though. I mean, I'm sure there of course are deep philosophical levels about that, but is it really so? Was that sacrifice really so necessary? You know, I mean, I'm sure there is some deep philosophical level on which it was somehow spiritual. Maybe that will forever remain a mystery. But I think the challenge in a way in films is to create a really necessary sacrifice, and one which is done out of love with no alternative. Yeah, I mean there. I think that, let's say, a hero where, in a way, you know that there will be no sacrifice, a kind of James Bond-like hero, will never be able to reach you very, very deeply. Mm-hmm. You know, if you know this person is going to be safe, it'll be a film can still be fun, but it will be fun like it will be to watch a Donald Duck comic or something like that. You know,
I was kind of wondering what the whether the reaction to the film, since it has now started to be screened here with some frequency, whether the reactions to it have in any way differed from those that you encountered in Toronto versus, obviously, the ones in Germany. I mean, are people as attuned or as aware of what the whole situation was in East Germany in the 70s and 60s, 70s, and 80s? Just kind of wondering about that.
I mean, in Germany, maybe when I meet people who've seen it or when I was there was less people know that this is what the political and historical situation was like. You know, that I think is an important point. They don't have to ask about it because they know that it's all true. You know, they know that even right down to the odor samples and the machine that steam opens letters, that all this is exactly how it happened. And they know that the Stasi was portrayed almost to maybe even not. Most writers, let me put it this way, most writers would have probably had more than just two people monitoring them and taking turns there. It would have been a larger group. I mean, people like Wolf Biermann, the greatest writer in the East, I wonder if you've heard that name, Biermann, Biermann. He's a slightly more literary Bob Dylan figure who writes these beautiful poems and then sets them to music and performs them himself. And he was in the East, and he was forbidden from performing his songs for, I think, 9 years. And he's like the prime literary figure of the East. And
did he stay in East Germany the entire time?
Yeah, he did. And then he was allowed to perform one concert in the East. And he was too famous. for them to actually for them to throw him in prison or something. So what they did is when he just went for a day trip to the east, and they did not allow him to come back to the west. So he was separated from his family, friends, lovers, everything, and he was not allowed to go back into the east. Mm. Really weird kind of punishment in a way, because of course he was on the free side, but but completely uprooted. That was a very weird that was a very weird thing. But you know, they know that someone like that would have had a team of at least a dozen Stasi people surveilling him, and but I mean, but the great thing is, and they also knew, of course, that from these figures, you know, among them him, but all others, we received from the you know, the powerful intellectuals and poets and artists of the East, great endorsements for the film. They all wrote, I mean, Biermann, for example, himself, whom I couldn't actually get into contact with beforehand. I kind of wrote to him lots of times, and then once I even went to one of his concerts, and then went to him afterwards when he was signing books, and I said, and I kind of bought a book just to stand there in line, and got to him, and I said, look, my name is Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. I've been sending you a few drafts of a screenplay. And then he was really angry and said, look, if I'm going to say something about the Stasi, I will say it myself, you know, and I will not talk to you about this. And I was really taken aback by that, and was actually even quite hurt, because the thing is, you know, he's this figure I really admire, and I really wanted his input on it, and I'd read all these books about him and about his troubles with the Stasi. But of course, you know, in these things, people often don't react very rationally because they were so hurt by it. But then, he never contacted me after he saw it. But then, one of the largest newspapers in Die Welt, which you've probably heard, Die Welt, W-E-L-T. It's a really big newspaper. Mm-hmm. He wrote a huge 3-page article about the film, saying how he even describing this incident, how he kind of barked me back, and how now he was feeling so bad about that because this captured so much the essence of what his life was about, and that then he said I thought something particularly beautiful. I mean, a lot of people wrote great things about it in Germany, but he wrote that in a way the one thing that really frustrated him about the Stasi was, even after he got his files, he could see these people knew everything about him. They knew how often he had sex with whom. They knew everything. Mm. But he did not even have a face to put to the people that knew everything about him. He said now, at least after this film, he felt like he had faces that he could identify with and know what the people were like. And he would always imagine my actors in those roles. And I was happy about that.
How was what little American reaction you have gauged? How is it different, if at all, from what happened in Toronto and Germany, though?
I think it was much like Toronto. You know, of course, that Toronto, it was just so, in a way, so special because in that Elgin Theater, just that huge group. I mean, you described it so well on your website. Actually, I remember going back and showing my wife, saying, "Here, look, this is what Jeff wrote about." And I think you described it really incredibly well. Where you remember how you then said, like, and then they turned towards each other and the actor and hugged each other. Yeah. He said, "Quite a moment." I thought that was really I liked that description a lot, because it was really like that. You know, we were just so happy at that reception, because we didn't know how it would do it played before a large audience there, and it, you know, in a way, what I really appreciate very, very much is that here people concentrate very much on the filmmaking achievement, and not just on the is it Ziggy?
Yeah.
No, all right, it is there. On the filmmaking achievement, not so much just on the you know, political side of it all, you know, because in that is, you know, of course, after all, you know, it is, for me, it is, of course, it is a story mainly about just people and about, and not so much just about a, you know, it's not that I wanted mainly to make a political statement. I wanted to make an emotional statement. You know, I mean, more something along the lines of what you were saying about sacrifice and love and humanity, rather than about political systems, so to speak, you know.
When I think of the film and I think of the shorthand and I talk to people about it, I think of, first of all, the intrigue, the thriller, the kind of the spy, political stuff, which is fascinating, and naturally the emotional, particularly in the lead. What's wrong with that? I can't even remember. I'm blanking on it.
Yeah, no, Visa?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but the third thing I mentioned is that it's really a sexy film.
All right, no, I'm glad you find that. Yeah, no, I mean that
Martina, particularly in that whole that's I don't know very many married people who have that kind of element in there, but it's and just everything that she exudes and all the
Yeah, well, I mean, I leave that open, buddy. I mean, but well, maybe they are. You know, I mean, it's just it's not just. I mean, it's not explicitly said one way or the other. They're at least they're kind of like married together almost. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they haven't. It's not just recently that they've come together. That kind of thing. You know. Mm-hmm. But they.
I'd love to ask a question, which is, you know, when I see a picture like this, and my reaction is so terrific. You know, I just had an interesting. I was just in a meeting, and I had an interesting debate with a guy who is very young, and who is very much a kind of a hip American technician. You know, whose favorite debuts are Memento and films like that.
Okay.
And I was talking about, you know, this is this is your first feature, right? As a fascinating debut, so sophisticated. Irony is that I just read an interview with Ridley Scott last night, right after seeing the film, and there's a quote which is fantastic, which I think is so relevant to this, which is the quote was, "Sentimentality is unearned emotion."
Unearned emotion.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think it's so easy when you were talking about the screening. It was marvelous. You know, setting up your characters for change without it being ostentatious or radical, thus look really superficial, that the change is so subtle as these two men totally change the way they see life and what they're willing to do in order to get what they want, that you earn so successfully the emotion.
That's
the great conquest that you have on the audience.
Well, thanks a lot.
It's so easy to tell a story like this and have it become enormously sentimental. And that was the other thing that I was admiring and respecting, which is how so many filmmakers here are very in a very cynical mode right now.
That's true.
That is
very true. I noticed that cynicism. I may have noticed that in the screenplays that
they're sending you.
Yeah, a little bit. Because the thing is, there's a lot of cynicism. You're completely right. It's so easy to be cynical. You know, that is the thing which I always find is in a way the biggest counter argument to it. It's just like, you know, like for an actor to place an unlikable part is really easy. You know, I can play an unlikable part. You know, I can say, oh, what is this? You know, here, there's a disgusting peppermint tea. It's, you know, let's send it back. You know, I can, you know, anybody can play that. You know, I'm not an actor. But to play, you know, the part of someone who would say, wow, you know, this is really great peppermint tea, that's much harder. You know, it's just so much harder to play a positive character, you know. And so in the same way, it's in writing. I can write you a gloomy, just depressing film with no outlook on hope, in a second. You know, it just takes no effort. And then you just get, a technically competent director, and they'll be able to turn it into a kind of sleek film, you know. But if you want to make a film that sends out any kind of message of hope, that's a real challenge. Mm-hmm. The more I found out about just the depressing side, how long do you think you have to let this?
It looks good.
Oh, yeah, okay, it looks good.
Yeah.
They told me
it would
be ready in a minute.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it looks good. You know, I totally agree because I read so many screenplays on a weekly basis.
Right.
And I can't believe how the level of cynicism has reached the point where they're killing off the heroic character with no reason for it.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Just to be kind of radical,
yeah,
and to be
right.
more cynical, and up the ante on the cynicism. It's interesting. As I look at your film and the time period that you've chosen to do it in, it's a time where everybody was already sort of numb with cynicism. Mm. Everything is gray. I love the way the film is lit. His apartment is too desperate for work. It's fantastic. And compared to the juxtaposition that the other apartment, the artist's apartment, which has art and flowers and paintings and everything in his, which is, you know, sort of pre-cooked dinners and hoes. The seeing that time period was already cynical. So there was a point where they wanted to break out, you know, clearly into a new romanticism. And so picking that as a basis for people who are desperate to sort of break free of their bitterness is wonderful. I think we're in a different cycle right now. I think we haven't peaked yet.
I got to tell you, I don't really respond to when I hear that something is cynical or that it's an upper experience, an up thing to watch, or something that has a positive ending or a negative ending. I don't respond to that at all. I just want to know if it all fits and if it's right.
Well, you know what? I know what you're saying, but at the same time, you know, I do have. I think for me, it's very important to not just if it fits and if it's all stylistically okay. I want to know if I want to know if I'm going to go out of that film feeling empowered. That's very important to me. And you know, if you take, and sometimes, you know, a film can have something which would appear to be a very dark ending. Let's say something like The Talented Mr. Ripley has a very tragic, dark ending. But at the same time, I do think that it is a film that empowers you, because even if a character like Ripley has reached almost moral bankruptcy, you can see so clearly where he could have gone right that it's almost as if he paints the positive image by painting the shadow, you know. So I think that, but that is important to me, and I really try and check very carefully before I go and watch a film whether I think it will give me that, and if I don't think so, you know, I'm not going to go and see it.
When I say right, I mean a sense of rightness, a sense of justice. I felt that the Stassi's character in risking and doing for them as he did. I felt that there was a kind of a rightness that he had, you know, the moment at the end in the bookstore. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it felt like a balancing moment. It felt satisfying.
Is that the only moment in the film that he actually smiles?
I think so. Probably.
Yeah, because I don't remember him you know, showing much emotion other than alarm.
It's pretty much the only. It's also pretty much the only time that he actually says I, know, or me, you know, because he always just talks of the cause or things and other people and so on. It's all about other people's lives and never about him. And suddenly it is about him, and that's that kind of, that's
Is he coming over?
He's coming over in January.
Okay. Yeah. What's going to happen next to that character, you think?
To that character, well, you know what? I think he's going to stay doing what he is, but doing it with a certain, doing it with a certain sense of, you know, that maybe the most important victories in life are not material victories. You know, that it doesn't matter if he's poor, and that it doesn't matter if he's not, you know, successful. Let's say that he's had the kind of success that counts, and that's been acknowledged, you know, by the people that matter to him, who in that case is the, you know, the writer.
And why do you think the writer didn't approach him when he saw him?
I think he probably felt that, you know, what should he have said? You know, thanks a lot, that was great. You know, it was, it's hard to.
No, it's funny, it was a great choice. Yeah, it was really a great choice, but as I felt the process there of you. Almost like as he hesitated and began to cross the street, that was you writing, sitting almost like at the computer.
I mean,
is there a line of dialogue coming up here?
I experimented with a few versions of them.
It
meeting,
felt like it,
but it didn't work. And I felt, you know, it was sometimes the best desires are left unfulfilled. Mm-hmm. You know, and now are the
The other thing, the fifth thing that I tell people, and I do have five things that I tell them, is that it's 2 hours and 17 minutes for credits, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I guess the movie's more like 2:10 or.
Well, yeah, but a little longer, probably, even, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it really doesn't feel like that. It feels like maybe 100 minutes, 110 minutes, and it really, really zips very long. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is a relatively simplistic question, but what would you say is the key thing in your film that doesn't make a drag? I don't know how else to say it.
Thanks. Thanks. I'm glad you find you see it like that, because that was that was the biggest. I was so worried that some distributor would come and say, "Look, we're going to take it, but if you cut 20 minutes out of it, you know." And I was just so living in fear of that it's almost a miracle that it didn't happen. I think it has to do with the fact that I think it's so important when you write something that you give enough information that the viewer can think for himself what he thinks will happen next, and then that's not what happens, you know. But you have to always give, I think, the viewer, the or the reader, or however you call it, you remember, you have to give them the possibility of thinking, oh yeah, okay, of kind of thinking all the time, so what's going to be next, what's going to be next? If that question dies in the viewer's head, what's next? That's the moment it starts dragging and gets boring. And, you know, I'm very aware of that when watching films. You know, I always think, when I stop asking that question, be it just for a second, you know, then it always gets in those questionnaires, you know, then it drags in parts. Yes, you know, that that's so you it's the what's next question that you have to keep awake, and but also you have to keep surprising them, because if the people ask what's next and they kind of imagine what's next and then actually that comes, then it becomes very boring if that happens a few times, you know.
Yeah. Mm. You know what I really one of my favorite scenes in the film is the bar scene.
All right, yeah. That's great, yeah. That was actually the actor's favorite scene, too. Well,
and now that I'm recounting it, I'm trying to remember who comes in the bar first. Now I can't remember.
Well, he comes first because he just kind of almost just stumbles in because he's becoming too conspicuous there on the street, and someone wants to just almost to disguise, and then he just decides to stay there and sits down, and then he can't believe that she actually comes in there, too,
it was almost as if he was watching television and the characters came off the screen.
Yeah, right.
Suddenly he could interact with them without a script.
That's right,
himself. That was it was like breaking some sort of interesting fourth wall.
Yeah.
And the astonishment and his underplaying, you know, I mean the astonishment that he was feeling at that point, but the way that he approached the lighting was so awful. Garish neon fluorescent.
Was it fluorescent light? I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was like
I remember a grim feeling, but
yeah,
I don't remember
they were green. They were just green.
You know, it's funny. I think I told you that when I honeymooned in 87. We went to only the Eastern Bloc countries.
No, you didn't tell me that.
We didn't want to. We wanted to get away from the McDonald's.
All right.
McDonaldization of Western Europe, and so we went to Leipzig and East Berlin, and I kind of
You and your wife, yeah. Or,
yeah. Okay. You weren't.
Are you still together, or?
We got divorced in 91.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But, two good kids, that's what counts.
Okay, that's what counts. But maybe you shouldn't have the honeymoon in the Eastern Bloc.
I remember thinking when you told me you were going to do that, that was an odd idea.
Oh, you've known each other that long?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Yeah. Well, okay, and you both went into films, yeah.
Yeah.
Or did you know each other from before you went into films?
I was a budding journalist, and she was an agent.
I was an agent at ICM at the time.
All right, okay. And then you left ICM to become a producer?
No, came out here and partnered up with another guy coming out of Morris, and other people joined up and formed sort of a literary boutique.
All right, okay.
Where I was a partner for many years.
Okay. Actually, at ICM, I know an agent, a New York agent from ICM, Bodhi Boatwright. Do you know her?
Yeah. How did you forget that name, right?
Yeah, that's right. She's a really nice lady, yeah.
Yeah.
She's the only ICM New York agent I know. But they have quite a large department there, don't they?
They have a lot of people there.
Anyway, in a perverse sense, I was trying to say that in a strange perverse sense, I kind of enjoyed the grim atmosphere of that East German bar, because I don't think you can find places like that anymore.
No, you can't. We had to build that.
That's
everything's
funny. Everything is very decadent.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, you know, they were shot, because we shot an actual bar that we were rebuilt completely, and it was really poor bar people. I really felt sorry for them, because it was actually in the East, and we could picture what it was like in the East because we had a lot of photographs of similar bars. And then we came to them, and they had, you know, everything decorated with, you know, beer logos and flowers and little doilies and everything. And then we said to them, look, we would like to shoot in your bar. And they were thrilled, because they thought, wow, finally someone had recognized their genius in decoration. You know? And then we turned everything out and rebuilt it to this really grim place. And then they were so upset. But then we rebuilt it for them exactly the way it was, and they were happy again. But said, please don't say this was our bar in the end credits.
How long ago did you start writing this?
I started writing I started researching in 2001, started writing in November of 2002, and then wrote from there on about another 1.5 years, and then and then it took another 2 years to actually finish it. So I'd say I spent almost 3 years writing it, including research. So half research, half writing, and then 2 years making the film. So in total, it's a 5-year labor of love.
One thing I was really impressed with, the single most impressive use of CGI that I've ever seen is Goodbye Lenin at the mm-hmm. very end, where the statue of Lenin is being helicoptered.
Do you think that's CGI?
I was told that is CGI.
Right, okay, because it looked so real.
Because it doesn't look like CGI.
No, exactly. Right, okay.
And I was just wondering, I never asked you, but did you ever try to CG anything to make it look older?
No, because I think that, I mean, the example of Goodbye Lenin would be a proof to the contrary, but I'm always disappointed by the historical use of CGI. I mean, I think that I really wanted things to feel completely authentic. I mean, I went to great lengths there. I went to such lengths that I even recorded the sound in analog. You know, they don't even have analog. They don't even make the analog tapes anymore. Mm-hmm. So I had this. I found this pretty old sound recordist who phoned around all his buddies if they still had some tapes in their attic, and they did. So, you know, we got that, but I wanted to have that analog feeling everywhere. I even, you know, went so far that when we had a sign designed for the bar or for something like that, I would insist that it would not be done by computer, but that it was done, you know, the way that they used to do it in the mid-80s, you know, mm-hmm. just by hand or with photo design. And I think that you can feel that difference a little bit, because, you know, everything digital is going to be ones and zeros, and the spaces between letters are just going to be identical, and it's just, I wanted it to feel real. You know, it only does that if you have, you know, human fallibility in every single letter, in every single object, and in the material that you shot it on. And I thought, you know, I wasn't going to shoot this on video, so I wasn't going to record it on DAT tape. You know, that's right.
That's very von Stroheim of you.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Why? What did he do?
Oh, he was known for his exactitude. He wanted to make sure everything was really authentic. Right, he didn't want to fake anything.
No. So I mean, that was important for us, you know, and those things, and also in things like, you know, if you can get something authentic, you know, sure. Best use it authentic. Right. But the reason why I think, you know, I'm glad you say you enjoyed the visuals of it as well, as, you know, I wanted to make it beautiful as well. That was really important to me. You know, I didn't want it to be, you know, just 2 hours of drabness, because then people wouldn't want to, you know, then it wouldn't be sexy.
Yeah, right.
You know, you have to somehow create, without lying, of course, but you have to create something that people would actually want to watch and would find elegant. I mean, there's no harm in elegance. You can have elegance in a prison camp, you know, if you make a film there. It's just it has something to do with choreography. You know, it's just like a ballet doesn't have to be set in a castle to be elegant. You can do a ballet set in the Sahara Desert or something, you know, and you can make that elegant.
Folks, I don't want to be rude. Okay, right, just one more question.
I'd love to ask.
Okay.
Not for the interview. Who is representing you here?
Beth Swofford.
Ah, great. Yeah, terrific. Yeah. So are you thinking of doing an American film next?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking of it. But I mean, it's just, you know, the thing is, what is an American film? Almost hard to know. I mean, I would definitely like to do something in English, because you can just reach that many more people. Mm-hmm. You know, I was seeing that where I was, you know, in a way, talking
most
to...
Most of the town senior film by now?
No, I wouldn't say. I mean, you'd have to answer that.
We're still in the process of screening.
People who work in Toronto.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, and exactly.
Really good turnouts, but everybody has seen it, no. Yeah.
No.
And so are you working on anything that you want to do next?
I mean, I haven't started writing yet, so I mean, I'll probably only see, since I'm traveling around with the film a little bit now, I'll probably only start writing in April or something.
And how can you...
When Ziggy tells me now, no, but, you know, now it's over. No, but...
how could you qualify the screenplay that you'd like to make next, as much as you can in the abstract?
Well, I mean, I'd like to make something that, you know, in a way does not, that uses the large canvas, you know, that is really made for the cinema, you know, mm-hmm. that doesn't, and that deals with just fundamental questions of, in a way, of mankind, you know, just something like, you know, love or death, or and that doesn't, you know, I'm not interested in, you know, films that deal with just little details or parts, you know, if they deal with, you know, that's what I like about Almodovar so much, and we were talking about earlier that, you know, he always deals with pretty fundamental stuff, you know, I mean, it's even, and it's not, you know, I don't know if I could, you know, make a film about, you know, I don't know, whether it's healthy or not, or about the anti-smoking movement or something like that. You know, I don't care about that. You know, it's just not, to me, that's just so peripheral somehow. You know, that sure. that I don't, I, that would not be something, you know, I may enjoy watching it, but it's just not fundamental enough for me.